Okay, last week we looked at the Braita that said four people went into Pardes. Tanu Rabbanan Arba Nit, this is on page 5 of some previous sources. Source 17. Tanu Rabbanan Arba Nitnasu LePardes, Elohein ben Azai ben Zoma va'achir Rabbi Akiva. Amr Lahem Rabbi Akiva, Kishiti Kansu, Eitzel Avni Shayesh Tahor, Alto Murmayim Mayim, Mishim Shinemar, Dover Shkarim, Lo Yukon the Neged Einai, Ben Azai Hitzitz Vamet. Ben Azai looked and he died. Which for us should be very, very simple. It means that Ben Azai, somehow involved in this experience which we're called Paradise, this mystical traveling, going up to Gan Eden, he dies. Rashi explains in source 18, he sits, he looked, Litzad HaShchina. Ben Azai looks at the Shechina, he looks at God's essence, whatever this means. The verse that's quoted is Yakar Be'ini Hashem Avtalach Hasidav, it's a verse from Psalms, which means precious in the eyes of God is the death of his saints. What do you now know about Ben Azai? So far, what do we know? One is we know that he's dead, and what else do we know about him? No. What do we know so far? What do we know? That he's a tzaddik. He's a chassid. Why? Yakar b'nei Hashem avtala chassidav. Not only do we know now that he is a chassid, what else do we know about him? That God takes his death very difficultly. So Rashi explains that and says, Yakar b'nei Hashem avtala chassidav, that precious in the eyes of God is the death of his saints. Why? Rashi says, Huksha mitato lifanav, the death God took very harshly. God, it was very difficult for God, this death. Lefi shemet bachur, because he died when he was yet a bachur. What does a bachur mean? A young man. He dies young. Which I guess for our terminology would be sort of like the impression we get that he died like as a teenager. He dies very young. V'afa pichei, nonetheless, efsher shelo yamut, it's impossible that he should not die. Why? Mishum shenemar, for the verse says, ki lo yireini ha'adam v'chai, man can see me and live. So therefore, what is the impression, what is our understanding? This is all last week's sources, right? What is our understanding of the death of Ben Azai? He dies young, he's a chassid, which we will call a tzaddik. And why does he die? That's the important question. Why does he die? Which means this is one of the dangers involved in mystical study. What happens when you take this elevator and you go up to a different dimension and you see colors that you've never seen before? You sense smells that you've never smelled before. You see a beauty of which just doesn't exist on this planet. One of the dangers then would be, and this is the connotation of Rashi, one of the dangers would be that you're just not going to want to come back. So what he does is, the problem with Ben Azai's mystical experience is that it's so profound that he chooses, if this is a choice, to go one step too far, which means if you're then to ask me, ultimately, what would be the difference between what happens to Ben Azai versus what happens to Rabbi Akiva? Based upon Rashi, it would sound to us that Ben Azai goes further than Rabbi Akiva does. Rabbi Akiva knows how to stop at a particular point, and therefore Rabbi Akiva is able to come back down. Ben Azai, on the other hand, according to Rashi, he dies chassid, he dies as somebody who's young. But nonetheless, it was impossible for any other conclusion to the story. Why? Ki lo yireini ha'adam v'chai. For man cannot see me and live. That's the conclusion. If we were to consult the books that deal with such things, which you can go from popular books like encyclopedias to more specific books, to try to find a biography of Ben Azai, what you'll find is the standard biography would say, pretty much what Rashi tells us here, maybe even adding one more element, would say he died young. He died by this mystical experience. Because he dies young is why he's called Ben Azai and he's not called Rabbi Shimon Ben Azai. You have Rebbe Akiva, why Rebbe Akiva and not Rebbe Shimon Ben Azai? So therefore you would have that he dies young, he dies because of mystical involvement. He is a Hasid. He never got married. Excuse me? We'll say, well, there's machlokes about everything. Now you're stopping me, there's a machloket.
No.
I know. I gave you the things to prepare. I know what it says here. As I said, again, if you were to look at the standard biography, you would be told that he dies young, he wasn't a rabbi, that he didn't get married, he didn't have children, that he was a chassid. Those are the various things that's the impression that you would get. And if you spent the last hour and a half or hour or so productively, then you'll now realize that there is a machloket on just about every single one of those points. Even, by the way, being a chassid, you have one source that I mentioned to you last week, and you may have seen it quickly, that said, whoever dies by the sixth gate, did you see that or you didn't see that? That when you go through the Heichalot, you get to the sixth gate, whoever says water, water by the sixth gate, his head is chopped off and he's thrown away, and he's accused of being a descendant of one of the people who kissed the golden calf. Minashke ha'egel. That doesn't sound like a very good thing. I know you've never heard that curse on the street, right? You must be a kisser of the golden calf, but within the mystical context, does not sound like a very wonderful thing to be. And again, I'm not exactly sure how you would reconcile that with what we're seeing over here, that he died, Yekar b'nei Hashem avtala chasidav. Ultimately, it may not be a contradiction, but that may be part of the tragedy. Let's see how far we can get today and see how simple this is or isn't. There is a thing which is called Asara Haruge Malchut, the 10 martyrs. I gave you 3 lists of the 10 martyrs, correct?
Yeah.
What did you notice with the 3 lists?
Different
Not just different orders. Also different names. So first of all, let me tell you a little secret about the 10 martyrs. The 10 martyrs did not live at one time. The Midrash that we're familiar with, which we mentioned last week, which is mentioned both in the Tefillah, in the keynote of Tisha B'Av, and is mentioned in the Yom Kippur service, in the Musaf service, both of them speak of the Ten Martyrs as if they live in one time, in one place, and it's some kind of a tikkun, of a spiritual fixing, for the sin of the sale of Yosef. The Rishonim already pointed out, and this becomes very simple when you look at the names on the list, that these people did not necessarily live at the same time. And being that they didn't live at the same time, the story is not the way it's told in those sources. Rather, those sources are coming from a later time and really gather together all the 10 martyrs and make one story out of them, which means that the 10 martyrs, as we're familiar with them, is more of a literary device than a historical reality. Now, don't misunderstand me. That doesn't mean there weren't martyrs. There were martyrs. I mean, let's just look at the list for a moment. And as we get to them, I'll mention when they lived, and then you'll see the problem. First one, Midrash Tehillim. Ki doresh tamim otam zachar. Ki shivo kadosh baruch hu li para paranut hatzadikim. When the time comes for God to take vengeance for the tzadikim, ulitvo damosha Rabbi Akiva, and for him to require, you know, vengeance on the blood of Rabbi Akiva, who tovei adamon shabar kufya, which a person won't get into, mal v'lo shachach tzakat anavim, what is it that God will not forget the cry of the modest ones? Einu shachach daman sheYisrael miyad umot olam, he won't forget the deaths of the Jews by the hands of the non-Jews, v'lo daman shel tzadikim, and not the blood of the righteous. But by the way, you're familiar with some of the terms over here from the Av HaRachama, right, that we say in Shabbat, which was composed as a result of the various blood libels that took place, and it was composed after the First Crusades. So what they did is they took verses, they took themes which go back, that God will require the blood of the righteous who've been killed. And it continues and it says, V'lo daman shel tzadikim bilvad. Not only will... Sorry, I skipped you, didn't I? Eino shechech daman shel Yisrael haruge malchut. Any Jew who was taken in and killed by the kings at that period. I didn't skip the first time. Eino shechech daman shel Yisrael miyad umot olam. V'lo daman shel tzadikim bilvad. Elo kol mi shenerag b'yimei hashmad. Anyone who's killed during religious persecutions, v'daman shel asera haruge malchut, and the blood of the 10 martyrs. So again, your impression would be they lived at the same time. Ve'elu hein Shimon ben Gamliel. Now, who is Shimon ben Gamliel? Mostly, now, the difficulty here is that there was both grandfather and grandson by the same name. Most likely, this is the grandfather for a very simple reason. He's killed at the same time as Rabbi Yishmael, which also, there are two Rabbi Yishmaels, ben Elisha, grandfather and grandson. But there's one more term here. Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha Kohen Gadol. So who do I think it is? I think it's Rabbi Yishmael who was Kohen Gadol. The grandfather was, the grandson wasn't. By the way, you realize the difficulty, don't you? Who does the word Kohen Gadol come to modify? Is Kohen Gadol Rabbi Yishmael? Or is Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha Kohen Gadol? Or Elisha was the Kohen Gadol? By the way, when you read in the Al-Hanisim, Bimei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Who was the Kohen Gadol? Matityahu or Yochanan? Yeah, Matityahu was never Kohen Gadol. Yeah. Right. I've seen very smart people make this mistake. When very, very educated people make this mistake, they say Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. They say Matityahu was the Kohen Gadol. He was not the Kohen Gadol. Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Over here as well, it's not so simple which one is the Kohen Gadol. You would write it the same way. Either way, the suspicion that we have is that this is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and Rabbi Yishmael, who lived during the time of the Beit HaMikdash. They were executed together with the Churban. This is a little bit before the Churban Beit HaMikdash. It then continues, Rabbi Yeshavav HaSofer, Rabbi Chutzpah HaMetorgaman, who are a bit later in time, Rabbi Yosef Yehuda and Bava, who's much later, Rabbi Yehuda Atanchum, Rabbi Shimon ben Azai, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradim, Rabbi Akiva, who are, you know, Rabbi Akiva doesn't die till around the year more or less 135, 140. So you realize this is not the same day as anybody who died during the Churban or immediately prior to the Churban, which is approximately the year 70. So right over here, you realize there is a time lag involved. This is not all at the exact same time. But for our purposes, what do we notice? That there is a man on this list named Rabbi Shimon ben Azai. And there's two things about this which are striking to us. What are the two things? First, he's called Rabbi. Correct. Over here, he's called Rabbi. Absolutely. What's the other thing which is striking? He's one of the martyrs. How can he be listed as one of the martyrs if we know very well that he dies during the Paradise experience? Now, what I won't go into any more than I already have is the interrelationship between the whole 10 martyrs theme and mystical studies, including Hechalot, including what I mentioned last time is Rabbi Yishmael. There is absolutely an interaction between these two different sources, but that's not going to resolve anything for us. Midrash Rabbah in Echa, the next source, Davar Acher, Bala v'lo Chamal, it's called Na'ot Yaakov, it's called the Avotav Shel Yaakov. All the beauty of Yaakov was swallowed up. Kegon Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Gamliel. Right before it was Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yishavav, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, Rabbi Chutzpah ben Turgaman, Rabbi Yehuda Nachtum, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, Rabbi Akiva, Ubin Azai, Rabbi Tarfon. So now you realize, and they says there are some who don't have Rabbi Tarfon, but have instead Realism and Charsna, which the list is not exactly the same, but what you do see is Ben Azai is on both lists. Again, was Rabbi Akiva martyred? Absolutely. Was Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol martyred? Absolutely. Was Shimon ben Leo martyred? Absolutely. Was Yehuda ben Bava? Absolutely. Hanani ben Tradion? Absolutely. All these are stories which are mentioned independently in rabbinic sources outside of the 10 martyrs theme. We know that all these people were martyred. Over here, as I said, there's the literary invention that puts all 10 into one greater theme in order to say that there's really a common denominator behind all of these deaths. Okay, as I said, and that's a very fair theme, it's searching for theological reason. How could it be that God can allow these people to die? So the answer is that these people are here in order to replace, as I said, according to the most famous of the Midrashim, to replace the sale of Yosef. By the way, how many people were guilty in the sale of Yosef? 10? So one second. Who's not responsible? Binyamin, he wasn't there. Who else wasn't there during the sale? Reuven wasn't there. Right? So now that... What? Okay. So far you have 10. Then the question is Yosef responsible? Which means that theoretically you have 9. So in order to get from 9 to 10, you then have to assume that one of the others have responsibility. Binyamin is the most difficult one to have responsibility. So therefore you're either going to have a thesis where you will blame Yosef or you blame Reuven. As I said, now you have a divertor. You can say, you just decide which one you want to stick in and why you want to stick them in. Okay. I'm not particular. In Otzer Midrashim, source number 3, Asar Hurge Malchut Fe'elohein, Rabbi Shmo ben Elisha, Rabbi Yeshua ben Sofer, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Chutzpah ben Turgun, Rabbi Kiva ben Yosef, Rabbi Chanina Skan HaKohanim, Rabbi Shimon ben Azay, Loz ben Charsum, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. Again, it's pretty much the same names, again, more or less, but you notice in all these sources, Rabbi Shimon ben Azay is mentioned. And you know what the easiest solution is, right? There's more than one guy named Ben Azay. Wouldn't that be the easiest solution? Okay, we're not going to go there because that doesn't work. In order to try to prove that, you would have to show that there are two different people who live at two different times whose both names are Ben Azay. You'd have to show somebody else Ben Azay other than Shimon Ben Azay. You'd have to show different context, different teachers, different students, and so on and so forth. You will fail if you try to do that. We are stuck. There is one Ben Azay, and we have to find out more about him. Correct. Fine. Midrash Rabbah has Ben Azay. On the other hand, Midrash Tehillim and the Otzer HaMidrashim, both of them have Rav or Rebbe Shimon Ben Azay. So as far as our first two contradictions go then, was he a rabbi, was he not a rabbi? And how many times do you want to kill the poor man? Does he die in Pardes or does he die with the 10 martyrs? Okay. So far that is our problem. Next has to do with his marital situation. The source number 4 is a Gemara in Masechet Yevamot. The Mishnah which causes the discussion is the Mishnah that talks about how many children a person should have, at which point the person can feel that they fulfilled the mitzvah of Pruruvu. Discussion, is it one son, one daughter, two sons, two daughters, two and two, one and one, one and two, and so on. The logic of one and one would be that you're replacing what you put into the marriage. The logic of two and two is that you've done a little better. Just prove, right, okay. Fine. Tanya, Rabbi Lezer Omer. Kol adam she'eino seik bepiriyav urivya ki'ilu shofech damim. Whoever does not involve themselves in the commandment of Pruvu is as if they're guilty of murder, spilling blood. Shenema, for it says, shofech dam adam adam damo yishafech. If a man spills the blood of man, his blood should be spilled. Uktiv batrei, and it says right in the same context, right afterwards, batem Pruvu. This is after the flood. This is when what we call the 7 mitzvot of B'nai Noach are given. And over here it talks about bloodshed on the one hand, and it talks about producing children. Rabbi, either Akiva or Yaakov, and there is certainly a relationship between the name Akiva and Yaakov, as you may have saw in at least one of the sources later on, says, Ki'ilu b'ma'it et hadmut. It's as if he has diminished the image of God. Shenemar, for it says, "Ki b'tzelem elokim asah et ha'adam u'samichle," and right next to it it says, "Vatem peruvu." So therefore, anybody who doesn't do peruvu is if they've somehow diminished the tzelem elokim. The logic in this would be, is that God, as a creator, brings life into the world. Man, in the image of God, therefore, when they bring life into the world, do something which is very, very godly. It's also interesting to note that there is a machloket. We all know that it says in Vayikra Perek Yutet, Pasuk Yudchet, it says, V'haf derecha kamocha. And Rashi there says, Amar Rabbi Akiva zeh klal gadol b'Torah. That's the greatest principle in the Torah. What we may not remember is that right afterwards, in the Midrash that Rashi is quoting from, and in the Yerushalmi, which is a parallel source, and in Bereishit Rabbah, which is a parallel source, it says, but Ben Azai argued with Rabbi Akiva and said, Zeh sefer todot adam, this is the generations of man, and the verse goes on to say, B'tzelem elokim asat adam. I believe it's Tzelem, but I don't remember right now how that verse continues. It says that on the day that God created man, this is Perikei Pasuk Aleph and Bereshit. It says, "Zeh sefer todatam biyom bara Elokim adam bidmut Elokim asato." And Ben Azai says that's the klal gadol mizeh. This is even a bigger klal than Rabbi Akiva's klal. That we had this discussion, I believe, earlier this year, Remember? I don't remember about what exactly is the machloka between Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai. But it is interesting that over here, Rabbi Akiva is saying that whoever doesn't have children is as if they've diminished the Tzelem Elokim, as if they've not really done what they needed to do. It then continues, Ben Azai Omer, Ben Azai comes and he says, whoever doesn't have children, ki'ilu shofech damim umimayat admut. Ben Azai basically says, you know, I'll match both of you. I think that you're both right. Whoever doesn't have children is guilty of murder and of diminishing the divine, of not manifesting the creativity within man, of the divine image within man. Shenema vatem peruvu. Omri lo le Ben Azai. The other rabbis say to Ben Azai, basically, it's a very nice drasha that you just now said, but excuse me. Yesh na'ed doresh. There are those who know how to preach well. V'na'em mekayem. Right? And they know how to act well. Na'em mekayem. But you know, Duresh, there's some people who know how to keep law, but they don't exactly know how to get up and preach. Vata noed Duresh ve'eino mekayem. And you don't practice what you preach. You get up and you preach, but you don't do what it is that you preach. Amar lahem, he says to them, Uma ese, what can I do? Shenafshi chashka b'Torah, for my soul is in love with the Torah. Efshe la'olam shetkayim adeyacher. The world can be carried on by others. So before we try to understand his answer, I'd prefer to try to understand the question. If the impression that we get from Rashi is correct, that Ben Azai dies as a young man, why are they attacking him for not being married? Why would this be such a bad thing? That he doesn't practice what he preaches? Yes, that's interesting. That's interesting. There's certain yeshivot that as soon as you get married, they call you rabbi afterwards, whether you learned anything or not.
No, it's the concept here, whether that's true or not.
Maybe. But I'm saying the question really an appropriate question? Is it fair to say to somebody, to attack him? You see, I mean, let me ask you something. When you read this source, did you get the idea that this is being said in jest? Or this is being said as a serious attack? This sounds like a very serious attack. It sounds, in fact, like Ben Azai has an ideological position, which, by the way, is confirmed when you see his response. What's his response? What do you want from me? What do you want from me? Correct. So I'm saying there's an ideological position here. It's not that, which means when they're attacking him, if he were only young, I remember when I was young, right? I was riding on a bus, and one of my rebbeim was on the bus there, and we start talking, and he says, listen, when it's time for you to start dating, when it's time to start getting married, he goes, the most important thing is you should marry a bat talmid chacham. Right? So what did I say to him? I said, is your daughter free? Right? And so that, which is obviously, right? Which is obviously going to be the response when somebody says it when you're young. I mean, you're not quite there yet, and he gave up on me at that point. But again, that was in context the appropriate response. Ben Azai over here is not taking this as a lighthearted conversation, which means at the point that they're attacking him, we're not that sure. The point that he responds, and he responds with an ideology, now we understand what their attack is. That Ben Azai over here is not simply some young guy. He's saying, but by the way, it is feasible that Ben Azai feels that the mitzvah of Puravu is not a mitzvah on individuals. It's a mitzvah on society. How can I back that up? What a v'atem pruvu. No, pruvu is to multiply. But the when it says v'atem pruvu, you, plurally. So it is possible that Ben Azai is saying the obligation, again, I'm putting words in his mouth now. The obligation is not on the individual, the obligation is upon the society, and the society is obligated. Now, once the society is obligated, how do I know if I'm obligated specifically? I'm busy doing something else, so therefore let other people be involved in this, but the society as a whole needs to reproduce.
But there is a connection. I don't remember what it is, but there really is a root connection to Uru to be Rav.
Okay. Rav means to multiply.
Rav also means to teach.
It also means to fight. Yes. Right, but that should...
That's part of the question. We don't know.
Correct, and that should be part of the response then. What do you want from me? Find me a shidduch. He did. He did, and I'm saying that's what he should have said. He should have answered like me. Find me a shidduch. Or if we'll do a little foreshadowing over here, who is speaking? Is it Rabbi Akiva? Is it Rabbi Yaakov? Who is it? If it's Rabbi Akiva speaking to him, then I think some of you now who saw the sources... Realize it's far more interesting, because he could have said, give me your daughter, which he could have said, okay, I will, or he could have said, I already did. So let's leave that for the moment. Okay, I would be careful. I would hesitate in trying to figure out the age of any of those kinds of terms, because let's not use modern Hebrew. Modern Hebrew is different from Biblical Hebrew, and Biblical Hebrew is different from Mishnaic Hebrew, and Mishnaic Hebrew is different from Rashi's Hebrew. Which means once we're going to have a term and we're going to try to figure out the age based on the term, be very careful. The term Yenukah, for example, which we'll see on Wednesday. What is a Yenukah? Literally, what does the word Yenukah mean? Yonek, somebody who's suckling still, somebody you would assume somebody who's still nursing, right? Yenukah is used for any little kid. There are terms that we have to be a little bit careful with. I'm willing to accept any suggestion what Bechor means. I would be a little afraid to draw any conclusions based upon it. And especially over here, it makes a very big difference if you're talking about somebody who's 9 or 10, or somebody who's 14 or 15, or somebody who's 19 or 20. Plus you realize, in terms of how long people lived in those days, 19 and 20 is completely over the hill, which puts us in a very, which puts all of us in a very bad position. Yes. Slow down. We're not up to that yet. We're not up to this. I never should have given you any sources. It empowers you too much. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Apparently that's what he's saying, but nonetheless, having just now said that if you don't have children, you're guilty of murder. Let me ask you a question. Learning Torah, murdering somebody, you don't murder somebody because you're learning Torah. I mean, murder wins out. Mimai tadmut sounds like a really bad thing. I don't know. Still ke'ilu, that's the point over here. If you're going so far to say you don't have children, as if you're mimai tadmut, you've diminished the divine within you. It's as if you're guilty of murder, so then you would assume that you're going to go out and at least try to find your shiduch. Over here, say, no, that's for other people. Me, I'm in love with the Torah. Let's continue. Based upon this source, was Benazai married or not?
No.
It sure sounds like no. It sure sounds like no, but let's admit something. We have no idea if he was married or not. We don't know. Not only don't we know if he was married, source number 5, which is a Gemara in Masechet Sota, also doesn't know if he's married. The context over here is, unsurprisingly, Masechet Sota deals with a Sota. What is a Sota? It's a woman whose husband warns her not to seclude herself with a particular man, not to go into locked doors with a particular man. The woman who then ignores her husband's warning and goes and locks the door together and alone with the man, that woman then goes through this whole process of Sota. The Gemara over here in Sota has a very simple, technical, somewhat embarrassing question. It wants to know, okay, locked behind closed doors, how long do you have to be behind closed doors to consider it to have been problematic? Okay? So if you want to see what the different opinions are over here in the Gemara, 5 different rabbis give 5 different opinions to how much time you need to be behind closed doors in order to assume that something may have taken place. As I said, if you want to find out what this is, then you have to go back and open the Gemara and look at the previous lines. The Gemara, though, has a different question. One of the 5 who expresses his opinion on how much time this should take was Benazai. But before that, the Gemara says, why do we have 5 different opinions? So Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav, Amar Yitzchak Bar Rav Yosef, Amar Rav Yochanan. We have a tradition which goes back to Rav Yochanan, 3rd century scholar in Israel. He says, Kol Echad Ve'Echad Batzmo Shi'er. Each one of the 5 rabbis, based upon himself, on his own experience. What else can he possibly say? Each one based on his own experience, how much time seclusion would be necessary for something halachically problematic to have taken place. See how delicate I am today with all this? What? It's very good, very good. My mother's not even here. So the Gemara then says, each one based themselves upon their own experience. The Gemara then asks, that's very nice. If each one based on their own experience, one of the 5 people who expressed an opinion was Benazai. It says, Vaha'ika Benazai, de lo nisev. But by the way, I've had trouble teaching this Gemara in modern times. I mean, I teach this to my students. I say, but Benazai wasn't married. And they'll look at me, yes, so what? Like, what does that have to do with anything, both in terms of personal experience or certainly in terms of personal knowledge? So the Gemara says, Ibayis Ema, there are 3 different suggestions. One is, Ibayis Ema Nasiv Upirish Hava. One opinion is, oh no, he must have been married at some point, but he separated. Nasiv Upirish Hava. Nasiv is like the word Nisuin. Nasiv, he was married. Upirish, and he separated from his wife. V'Ibayit Ema, some explain, no, Mirabish Mayale. That when you learn halacha, this is one of the things he needed to learn. So this, he's just expressing the opinion that he heard from his teacher. The ibayit ema, the 3rd one is sod Hashem liyareiv, that God tells His secrets to those who fear Him, which is itself is a very interesting term, not applied to everybody. How does Benazai know this? God revealed it to him. So. Yes, absolutely. It certainly supports the general impression that we have of Benazai being a chassid, being somebody who's special. He's the kind of person that God would reveal secrets to. But let's notice something. This question is raised 3rd century. They don't know how to answer this. They do have this general impression that Benazai wasn't married. They have this general impression that Benazai wasn't married. They're not even sure if he was married or not. Meaning, they don't know by the 3rd century, how to say pshat, how to explain Ben Azai's being attacked by the other rabbis for not having children, Is it that they're attacking him, you know, as our first impression based on Rashi? He died young, and then the whole thing is very strange. And then only then, by his response, do we realize what the rabbis knew who attacked him, that there was an ideological position over here. But over here, how does he have this knowledge? So one suggestion is, well, maybe he was married. Maybe he was married and he separated from his wife. A suggestion that we will actually be able to bring evidence to from an obscure midrash that we located, that hopefully you saw. But as I said, the Gemara itself offers other suggestions because it doesn't know how to answer it. And says, well, maybe he doesn't know himself, he just heard this, or maybe, and again, then it divides into two possibilities. Either he heard it from his teacher, or God somehow revealed such information to him. As far as Ben Azai having perhaps been married, the very famous story in source number 6, right, that is a famous story. The very, very famous story in source number 6 about Rabbi Akiva's relationship with his wife. And by the way, not just famous story, disturbing story, right? I mean, the personality of Rabbi Akiva is one which there are certain elements of his biography, of his life, that we absolutely, totally identify with, and we think that we understand and we look up to, and there are certain aspects of his biography that we don't begin to understand. You know, I don't know how many of you were separated from your husbands for 2 or 3 weeks, and it could be, let's be honest, the first couple of days is pretty good, but how do you sustain a relationship when you're separated for 24 years? And people attacked her for this, and she said, what are you talking about? And she's fine with this. Listen, the various people who teach in seminaries, who teach the girls that they have to go support their husbands in Kollel, because look at Rabbi Akiva's wife, how she supported him through all these years, are doing an unbelievable disservice to marriages, because you find me somebody who's learning like Rabbi Akiva on the one hand, and you find me somebody who is on such a level on the other hand, and then you can suggest that maybe that she should be supporting him and not see one another for 24 years. Till you find me couples like this, then I think that they're doing this, as I said, unbelievable disservice, because it's just not true. We do not understand, we do not begin to understand the relationship, and we don't understand the soul of Rabbi Akiva. By the way, listen to the words of his wife. I mean, you went through the whole source over here. At the point when they finally get together, after 24 years, somebody wants to lend her clothing, and what verse does she quote? Yodeyat tzadik nefesh behemto. Right? Yodeyat tzadik nefesh behemto. I'm sure glad I didn't quote that verse when referring to her. She says, Yodeyat tzadik nefesh behemto, that our relationship is one based upon, it's not based upon the physical, it's not based on anything else, it's based upon neshama, and so on. I do want to point something else out about this source, which I've always found interesting. There's only two places in the Gemara that it mentions to us that Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students. One of them is over here, and the other source is when it tells us the 24,000 died because they didn't treat one another properly. I wonder, when it tells us that Rabbi Akiva and his wife are able to have this unbelievable relationship, even though they're separated from one another, what kind of impact this has on Rabbi Akiva's students? Which means, even when Rabbi Akiva's students over here come with him back to his hometown, as it were, and this old woman comes and tries to see the rabbi, so what do? They push, they push her out of the way. Right, I mean, that's the Jewish approach. When an old woman, possibly a widow or someone, comes to speak to the rabbi, of course the proper thing to do is to push her out of the way as much as you can. And over what? Especially if you're religious. So, and then Rabbi Akiva's famous response, which has been overly quoted by every rabbi who writes a book, by saying, leave her, because everything that I did and all that I have and all that you have is basically comes from her. I refuse to write that in any of my books as an introduction. It's become a cliche already. It's not a... It's a cliche, but if you think a second, Rabbi Akiva's students, how do they come off in this story? They don't come off all that positive, and therefore I have to wonder out loud, what impact did it have on his students, never sitting around Rabbi Akiva's Shabbos table and watching him sing Eshet Chayil to his wife? Which means, Yeshivas are places that have a great deal of testosterone, and you have chavruta to attack one another. When I actually are coerced at times into giving advice to new chatanim, one of the advice I give them, especially if somebody learned in yeshiva for a while, is don't think you're getting a new chavruta, right? Do not treat your wife as a chavruta, because that is definitely a recipe for disaster in a marriage. What do chavruta do? They yell at one another. They tell each other, you're an idiot. You don't know how to read. What are you talking about? This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And that's what they do. That's what they do in yeshivot. And you sort of get the sense over here, also among Rabbi Akiva's students, they don't know how to treat a lady. They don't know how to treat... If a woman's coming in, I mean, think a second. If an old woman is walking in to speak to the rabbi, so what do? You part like the Red Sea, and you make room for her, and she has to speak to the rabbi. I mean, again, isn't this basic, you know, Jewish values? And nonetheless, when you see that these are the two times I talked to Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students, as I said, I have to think out loud about the impact that it may not have had Rabbi Akiva and his wife, but the impact that it may have had on his students. But let me ask you something. But I won't criticize Rabbi Akiva. I won't criticize him. But I will question what in the world is going on. Right? I will question that. What is going on in this relationship? And I will explain that before we finish today. But... No, it says over here. It says that he came to visit her.
No, I mean, like, not every white lady.
So, one second. Let me tell you what's not written here. There is another Gemara in Masechet Nedarim. To make it fit into the pages, I cut it out. Because it just basically repeated what you just now saw. But there are a couple... I cut it out. It's not here. You don't have it. There is another Gemara that also tells the story. It has a couple of differences to it. One difference is... It becomes very clear to us that Rabbi Akiva and his wife lived together for a while. It wasn't that just get married, go away. Yushalayim Shel Zahav is mentioned in that story, correct? Is the straw, right? Correct. Eliyahu Navi came and asked for a straw. That whole thing is in another story. As I said, it wasn't necessary for this, or so I thought. But that story is very clear that they lived together for a while. Apparently, they also have children. By the way, how many times was Rabbi Akiva married? Most likely three times. Most likely, he was already married with children before he meets Rachel. Again, he's not a young man at this point. Rabbi Akiva already has older children by this point. And as a matter of fact, the source that you saw last week, it says that when Rabbi Akiva went finally to learn in yeshiva, he says he sat in first grade with his kid. He sat learning Aleph Bet with his kid, which gives you one of two possibilities. He already has a child from a previous marriage, or he was with Rachel long enough beforehand that he has children who are old enough to go and study together with. As I'm saying, is that this story really is somewhat truncated. We don't get the entire picture over here. There is more going on. Okay? So let's leave it at that. But you know, most likely. The Rambam says he was a son of a ger. There's a Gemara in Masechet Berachot that says that the day that they replaced Rabbi Gamliel in the Beit Midrash, remember, you know, this famous day that there was this whole fight that took on, that was the day that Lazar ben Azariah grows a long beard and he comes Kiben Shivim Shana, they wanted him. So one of the candidates to replace Rabbi Gamliel is Rabbi Akiva, and the Gemara there says, no, Rabbi Akiva can't because he doesn't have Zchut Avot. Right, that's as close as we get to telling us exactly who he was. He doesn't have zchut avot. So the Rambam, in his introduction to the Mishnah Torah, where he goes through a whole list of the Rambam does something remarkable. He goes from Moshe Rabbeinu to his father in order to show you his exact Mesorah, his exact tradition. Basically, it's saying, you want to know where I'm getting this from? Here's where I'm getting it from. And as he goes through the entire list, all the way to his father, he gets to Rabbi Akiva, he says, Ben Geremaya. He says, Rabbi Akiva was the son of a ger. It doesn't say that in the Gemara. The Gemara says, Ein lo zchut avot, that's the Mesorah that he has. Are there those who've claimed that Rabbi Akiva himself was a ger? I believe that there have been those who've made that claim, but it's all that says, Ein lo zchut avot. That's all that the Gemara says. One can assume what they want. As I said, within the context of this story, and as I said, this disturbing tale of Rabbi Akiva and his wife, of getting married and falling in love, and it's very romantic and so on and so forth, except for the fact that they don't live together for 24 years. And again, let's also be honest, this point of him coming back after 12 years and overhearing her say, well, it's up to me, he'd stay another 12 years, he goes, oh, okay, and he turns around and walks away. And of course, everyone wants to know, you know, why didn't he at least go inside, at least give her a kiss on the cheek, and then turn around and go back, or maybe have dinner. I mean, it's ridiculous. I remember when I was in yeshiva. I know. So we have to be careful. As I say, I remember when I was in yeshiva, the rabbeim were trying to convince us how we should spend all summer in the yeshiva also, because in summer kids go to camp. So they said, no, you have to learn all summer. So he brought this gemara and he says, why don't Rabbi Akiva at least go in and say hello and whatever? Because he says, because 12 and 12 is not the same thing as 24. Learning for 12 years and for another 12 years is not the same thing as learning for 24 straight years. Because 24 straight years is... And by the way, I will tell you honestly that when I was sitting in yeshiva, I did learn at some point. I mean, I know that now you just think that I just get up and talk. But when I did learn in yeshiva, there's a very big difference between a week where you start Sunday morning and then you end Friday and then you go home for Shabbos, you go away for Shabbos, versus spending a Shabbat in the yeshiva, a second Shabbat in the yeshiva. If you spend 3 weeks in the yeshiva, the intensity, it's not just 1 week and another week and another week. 3 weeks of learning is much more than learning for 3 weeks, if that made sense. So, but still, what are we talking about? That Rabbi Akiva and that they should be separate for 24 years is really quite difficult, quite disturbing. What's interesting to us, however, is the conclusion of the story. Yeah.
How do you know that, I mean, it's a bit like, all right, you haven't got modern-day travel, you can just take a, you know, just take a bus and take a train or a car, and you can see it while you're traveling. But how do you know, what was the concept of sending my husband away to learn for 12 years, and yet... they were still married and he still had a relationship and she was there for him. I mean, it's really more of a concept than just saying goodbye. You know, if I'm giving you 2 years to go and learn, you don't have to look for a man. I'm here working for you, and then you come back and whatever.
So you've just now described the Kola wife syndrome, and you're saying this is what's going on over here. So you fell for it.
Well,
how did you fall? All this is agreed, but again, let's not be guilty of the easiest mistake that we can ever make when learning rabbinic texts. And what's that? Taking modern examples and reading them back into ancient texts. Read what the text says. We're told a disturbing tale of Rabbi Akiva and his wife Rachel, who have a marriage which we don't understand. 24 years they're separated, and then they don't even meet up because he hears her say, I'd rather him sit and learn. Look, the incredible hero in this story, in the life of Rabbi Akiva, there's no question, is his wife. I have a lot more to say about this. We'll limit it to this, but what we will note is that she apparently notices that here is a person of unbelievable capability who, if he only were to learn, could do something very significant. And of course, she is right, which means... who created Rabbi Akiva? A woman named Rachel. She created Rabbi Akiva. So, okay, so listen, we all take our hat off. Don't do that literally. We all take our hat off to him, to her, and say, listen, she was right about this. The price that was paid was, on a personal level, absolutely, you know, a disaster on a personal level. And by the way, let's also be honest. In all types of positions of leadership, be it rabbis or other positions of leadership, very often it's the immediate family who's going to suffer because somebody is going to be, you know, giving themselves to the community. And that's a price which is on the children, it's on the wife, or it's on the husband, depending on who it is. But there's a price to be paid over here. Rachel accepts this, she encourages this, because it's the choice that she makes. And as I said, for us there is something very disturbing about this. On the other hand, when we get to the end of the story, we get this part which seems almost to be forgotten. Second line from the bottom. Barte de Rabbi Akiva of de Leila ben Azai Hachi. The daughter of Rabbi Akiva had the same relationship with Ben Azai. By the way, what does that mean? Okay, great. I also don't know what it means. It means that they had the same type of relationship, which means some kind of marriage, quasi-marriage relationship, separation, and so on. V'hainu da'am... Correct.
And maybe they were never married, but
correct.
She realized that he was really married to the Torah,
so we agree. We don't know what it means. The Hainu de Imri Inshi, and this is what people say, Rechela Bata Rechela Azla. What's a Rechela? It's a lamb. It's a ewe. So by the way, you notice, of course, the plain words over here, because her name is Rachel. So it says, Rachel, the daughter of Rachel, that's the plain words. Avde ima kach avde barta, as mother like daughter, as daughter like mother, right? That's what it says over here, which means that now we know that Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai are actually far more related than we would have thought earlier, not just friends or chavrutot or what we call the tamid chaver, but rather may actually be a relationship of father-in-law and son-in-law. Source number 8. Source number 8 is Midrash Shir HaShirim. The edition that this is from is called the Groenhurt edition. It is a book that was missing from the Jewish community for many, many years. As some of you may know, there was in Cairo, in Egypt, this incredible Gniza. Gniza basically means big garbage can. In Shul in Cairo, instead of throwing things away, they just kept throwing things in a room there next to the Ezrat Nashim. Old books, right? You know, like we would, in our terminology, we would say Shemus, right? What does Shemus mean? Something with the name of God in it. The Shem, Shem Hashem, is Shemus. So what they would do is they would take all the things that were holy that fell into disuse for whatever reason and throw them in. Now realize that this had been going on. This is a garbage can collecting for more than 1,000 years. They found more than 1 million pieces of paper in there when it was finally taken out and worked on. There's still things in it that have not been completely identified. You can still go into Gniza studies if you have a lot of spare time. Also realize that things have been collecting for more than 1,000 years. The printing press is not that old, which means you have a lot of handwritten manuscripts. They found letters of the Rambam, the Rambam's autograph on them. They found all kinds of things. That they also found books, manuscripts, that have been lost. One of the manuscripts they found was a Midrash in Shir HaShirim. One of them, the Midrash in Shir HaShirim, it reads as follows. Hashishi ben Azai. What is the Shishi? Over here is the sixth of the 10 martyrs. Of course, the irony is that according to the opinion that he got killed by Hechalot, he's killed by the sixth Hechal. The sixth was ben Azai. Amr love ben Azai, it was said of ben Azai, Shanasa bito Rabbi Akiva, that he married Rabbi Akiva's daughter. Pamachat, one time, Amarla, he says to her, which implies that they're married for a bit of time. He says, he vi'i kiton shamayim, bring me some water, she'erchatz et yadi, ad shelo ekra kriyat shema, so I can wash my hands before I say kriyat shema. The implication is that this is kriyat shema at night, before they would go to sleep. Ukisharaya tamayim, when he sees the water, biyada in her hands, hitchil yoshev doresh. He sits down and he begins to be doresh. Now, what does the word doresh mean? Right, but what did I tell you last week that it can also mean? It can also mean meditate. It can also mean meditate. And the word the translation of meditation works over here. Yoshev vidoresh. He begins to sit and to expound, but it sounds very much like he is going into some type of a meditative state. Yoshev vidoresh almi madad bisha'alumayim. He quotes the verse in Yeshayahu chapter 40. Min ha'erev ad haboker. He's looking at the water, meditating on the water. By the way, that is quite interesting. Why? The water is the right, Gishit, right? Altar Mermayamayim over here. He's looking at the water and he's meditating all night long. Vihio Medidarosho, and she's standing right next to him. Bisof, after all of this, Tala Ina Vistakaba, he comes out of it and he looks at her. Amarla, and he says to her, Ad achshav at omedet kan? Till now you've been standing here, the whole time? Amra lohein, she says, yes. Amarla, he says to her, L'chi levet avich, go back to your father's home, she'i afshar li b'isha. He goes, I can't remain with the wife. I heard you were discussing before if this is that he mistreats his wife or he treats her nicely over here. I'm not, obviously, you all have the same right as I do within a text to interpret it as you please. It sounds very much that he's saying over here is that this is a ridiculous relationship, and I'm not gonna hold you like this over here. He's sitting and going off into these mystical trances. He says, go home. Omrelo, she says to him, Adoni iska liot mishameshet otcha. Let me at least just be the one to take care of you. Which is very similar to what we just now saw in the previous Gemara, that Rabbi Kiva's wife becomes this person, complete self-sacrifice, to take care of her husband, and we're told that Ben Azai has the same relation with Rabbi Kiva's daughter. And the dot, dot, dot over here is because that was the bottom of the page in the manuscript, and it's missing. And the top of, we don't know. We don't know what the answer is. The top of the next page begins, V'tafsu oto v'beit ha-midrash ragu, and they grabbed him out of the Beit Midrash and they killed him. We don't know. We don't, you know about him, because then it goes to the seventh person afterwards. Yeah. Ben Azai was grabbed out of the Beit Midrash, and he was executed. Executed. Right. Which, by the way, this fits in exactly, this is the theme of the Ten Martyrs. He's one of the Ten Martyrs. He's Rabbi Kiva's son-in-law. He's married, but now we realize, remember the Gemara had three possibilities? What the relationship was, and one of the possibilities that they were married and separated, that seems to be the one which is validated here. More than that, why do you think the rabbis would have attacked him the most? If he was young and never got married? Or if his mystical experiences caused him to come to a state where he just says, I can't remain married, I need to, I can't be with the wife. Which means, when they attacked him, and they say, don't practice what you preach, what did they say to him? What were the words? Yesh na'e doresh v'na'e mikayim. It may not simply be you don't practice what you preach. Yesh na'e doresh may be that you are involved in mystical study, you're involved in meditation, you're involved in all these things, but it's affecting the way that you're keeping Torah. That's obvious, which means, for mysticism to be the culmination of somebody who's leading this wonderful rabbinic life is one thing, but for you to be involved in these kinds of studies and for it to have a negative impact on the way that you lead your life, that's something completely different, and then it would make much more sense, their attack that they're waging upon him. I do want to make a suggestion, which I'm going to then prove, as to what is going on in Ben Azai's mind, and for that matter, what is going on in Rabbi Akiva's mind. Which means, let's think together for a moment. If I were to tell you that Rabbi Akiva and his wife separate for an incredible long amount of time, we saw that. As I said, we find this somewhat disturbing. Somebody, I heard before somebody said under her breath that it's sort of like a priest and so on and so forth. And clearly, this type of asceticism is something with Judaism is not going to be encouraging. It's not going to encourage it for many reasons. First of all, because it's not healthy. Secondly, it's not emotionally healthy. Thirdly, the idea of B'Tselem Elokim, we're being told by Ben Azai himself, is associated with being very close to God. I mean, we're told there's almost nothing that you can do which is as great as bringing a child into the world, because that's really a manifestation of the Tzelem Elokim. I mean, I don't have to speak about the Catholic Church. And, you know, you just have to read headlines in order to realize. But it's worse than that. Do you realize what the philosophical position is behind it? It's basically saying that God created the world, God created all kinds of pleasure, God created all kinds of wonderful things, and says, I was just kidding, I don't want you to touch any of it. There is something very disturbing about that. The Jewish approach would be quite the opposite. God gave us a wonderful world and said, enjoy the world, again, within context, enjoy the world. But to be able, this thought that you should deny oneself pleasure for whatever reason seems to be incorrect. And I can assure you that Ben Azai becomes a very disturbing character for us, and we still need to understand where he's coming from. But for that matter, this episode or this aspect of Rabbi Akiva's life is also disturbing. But what I want to ask of you is something very simple, and that is to think laterally a little bit. When I talk about somebody who separated from his wife, give me a prototype of somebody who separated from his wife. Moshe. Not only does Moshe separate from his wife, but in fact, one second. First of all, why does Moshe separate? What?
Well, Moshe separated because Hashem told him that you have to be ready to be the stay of the
Lord. So it's interesting. The separation that takes place between Moshe and Tzipora actually takes place for the entire Jewish community as preparation for Har Sinai. Correct? Everyone else is told to go back to your tents. Moshe is the only one who doesn't. And again, that's why Miriam and Aaron attack. Right? By the way, it's interesting with Miriam. Miriam feels she has the right to get involved in this. Why? Exactly. Remember I said that last year? I said that last year, 2 years ago. 3 years ago, what? I said that last year. Because she was the one who got involved when her parents separated and said that you should get back together. Now Moshe's separating. She thinks she should get involved. And God says, you're making a mistake. It's not what you think. That Moshe is on this level of constantly being prepared for Nivuah. Now let's go back a couple of steps. All the way back to the first class that we had, when was that? Last Wednesday, right? The one that I confused you terribly on. Remember that one? What was the mystical process? What was the core of the mystical process? Prophets would see visions, write down words. Mystics would read the words and try to re-experience the prophecy. What do you think are the various candidates for topics of mystical study? So what did we see then in the first class? We saw that the Maaseh Merkava, the vision of Yechezkel, is a great topic. Why? Because on a relative level, Yechezkel is on the lowest level, and therefore it's easiest to access. But let me tell you another time, which should have been maybe the greatest topic within mystical study, and what's that? That's Revelation. Revelation at Sinai. Why? Because here's a time that the entire people are able to look up and to see the heavens. As I said, I have to try to prove this still. If, on some level, Moshe and or Ben Azai are trying to re-experience Har Sinai as a mystical experience, we would then understand exactly why this theme of separating from their spouses comes into both of their biographies, because we now know where it comes from. This is the preparation for Sinai. I don't have to go any further to try to show the parallels between Moshe and Rabbi Akiva. Correct? We spent time on that last time. Now you realize that Rabbi Akiva and Moshe are very similar to one another, even, and this may perhaps be the deeper level of understanding why Rabbi Akiva stays separated from his wife, because there is this quasi-Moshe aspect about Rabbi Akiva. Ben Azai attempts to do the exact same thing as his friend, chavruta, colleague, father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva, but with one difference. What's the difference? Rabbi Akiva already has children, at least from one wife, maybe from two already. Rabbi Akiva is a bit older when he does this. Rabbi Akiva gets up to this level. Ben Azai tries to emulate Rabbi Akiva, and he tries to do it at an earlier stage, and he's not quite ready for this. Which may exactly present to us the tension within trying to record Ben Azai's biography. Go back to the point, is he a rabbi, is he not a rabbi? Well, in terms of his scholarship, of course he's a rabbi, but do you want him to be the model? Do you want him to be the role model? Because he becomes a very dangerous role model because of his desire to reach these highest possible levels of mysticism, and that's where this idea of separation comes from. By the way, all this I'm just saying right now, it seems like it fits, but I still have to try to prove it, and I will. So let me go one step further, and then we will reconcile all the sources that we've seen today. Because you're still stuck with some other. So far I've tried to reconcile, is he married or is he not married? What's the answer? He is married, but he separates. And that's why they attack him for not being married. It wasn't that he was never married. He was married and he leaves his wife. Why does he leave his wife? Because he's involved in these mystical studies. Was he a rabbi? Was he not a rabbi? Yes, he was a rabbi, but what happens? he becomes a very dangerous role model. Do you want all the little, all the yeshiva bachim looking up to Ben Azai and all of them saying, I'm going to be on a very high spiritual level and I'm going to separate from my wife? I mean, around 25 years ago, there were a couple of people in Bnei Brak who decided that the Gemara has various attitudes towards sex. As I already said in the first class about things about sexual things you're not allowed to talk about publicly, but I'll just say this far publicly, that the Gemara itself is contradictory information, because in different generations there have always been people of different attitudes towards it. There is even one, you know the whole rumor about people having relations through a sheet?
Yes.
There is a Gemara about it. The Gemara rejects it, but there is a Gemara about it. There were a number of people in Bnei Brak who said that we want to live on this kind of a level. And the stipler, if you know who that is, the stipler of Rav Kanevsky, he wrote a letter. He wrote a public letter. He didn't sign it, by the way. Everyone knows it's from him. He didn't sign it, but he wrote a letter saying, how dare you try to make believe you're on some high level at your wife's expense? Who do you think you are? And again, it was a scathing attack against these people, because he said he did not want this to start to catch on as the next chum in Bnei Brak. Right? Obviously, you know, you keep on going that kind of chum, you don't have any Bnei Brak anymore. Right? But again, he got up as public as he felt that he could, because not only did this letter go around, it goes around today to every yeshiva guy who's about to get married. They give him the letter of Rabbi Kanevsky. As I said, he just didn't sign his name at the bottom of it, but everybody knows that he wrote it, and it is accessible. But now you realize the kind of danger that somebody like Ben Azai would have. This is the highest level of the yeshiva bachur, is that you never get married, you separate from your wife, and you live off in your monastery, as it were. Take a look at source number 10. Zotia Torata Mitzarahu Dichtiv the Rosh Hashanah Lokim Alech Lesperchuki V'Tasi Briti Alai Picha Ben Azai Yoshev V'Doresh Ve'Eish Malahetet Sivivotav. Ben Azai was once Yoshev V'Doresh. What does Yoshev V'Doresh mean? Sitting and meditating, and V'Ha'Eish Malahetet Sivivotav, and a fire is surrounding him. Amrulei Shema B'Sedrei or B'Chedri Merkava Ta'osei. You must be doing the Maaseh Merkavah. One of the things Merkavah is the Chashmal. You must be sitting there and doing some kind of mystical thing, because normal people, when they sit and learn, the room doesn't break, you know, start a fire. He's sitting and learning, there's a fire surrounding him, and people say, are you doing Merkavah? Are you doing something incredibly mystical? Amar them love. No. Ela machriz divrei Torah le-Nevi'im, le-Nevi'im le-Ketuvim. I am studying the Torah, connecting the Torah to the Navi, the Navi to the Ketuvim. Divrei Torah smechim ki yom netinatan b'sinai, ikar netinatan b'esh netnu. Ahu dechtiv ahar bo'er b'esh. What does Ben Azai say that he's doing instead? What is the topic of his study? He is re-experiencing what is taking place by Sinai. Which means that if over here I have a source of Ben Azai involved in a mystical pursuit, and what we're hearing over here is very clearly, in his words, he's re-experiencing what's taking place by Sinai. In my mind, this clinches the thesis that what Ben Azai is constantly trying to do is re-experience Sinai. But that would therefore necessitate this idea of separation. And the separation of Ben Azai is like the separation of Rabbi Akiva. And the separation of Rabbi Akiva is like the separation of Moshe. And the separation of Moshe is something which was mandated by God, which is a preparation for the experience by Sinai. Which means, if you think logically, it makes sense that Ma'amad Har Sinai, revelation at Sinai, should be a primary topic for revelation, for mystical experience. But now you begin to realize the dangers involved in that as well. As far as the primary source that we started with, it says Ben Azai went into Paradise and he died. We still have, again, make up your mind. Does he die by Paradise, or does he die with the 10 martyrs? So I'll make a very simple suggestion to that as well, based upon source 12. There are four people who, even though they're alive, are considered as if they're dead. Arba cheshuvim kimetim. There are four people that are as if they're dead. Eluhein, ani, suma, umitzara, umisha ein lo banim. Somebody who's blind, somebody who's a leper, somebody, sorry, somebody who's poor, somebody who's blind, somebody who's a leper, and somebody who has no children. If Ben Azai's involvement in paradise leads him to the conclusion that he needs to separate from his wife and therefore put himself in a situation that he won't have children, it's possible the rabbis are saying that Ben Azai dies at that point. It doesn't mean that physically he dies. As a matter of fact, let me show you something. And this, as far as I can tell, is missed by all of the commentaries. Go back and let's read that first source again about the four who went into paradise. What I want you to notice is the interaction between metaphor and literalism. And I want you to tell me which one of these things are metaphoric and which one are literal. Tana Rabbanan arba nichnasu lepardes. Four people went into paradise. Is that literal or metaphoric? Literally, they went into a paradise, or is that a metaphor? Literally, they went... No, that's... Yeah, of course the paradise is a metaphor. What's it a metaphor for? Meditation, to go into Gan Eden, and so on. Four went into paradise. And it wasn't literally they walked into a field. That's not what it means.
No.
Right. Who are they? Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Achi, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says this whole thing about the water and so on. You'll decide if that's literal or metaphoric as well. Next it says, Ben Azai looked and he died. So now our question is about his death. Next. What does it say? Ben Zoma hitzitz v'nifga. What does nifga mean literally? Injured. He got hit, right? It's not literally he got hit. He went crazy.
Pagua.
What's next? Next is Acher kitzetz b'netiot. What does kitzetz b'netiot mean? It means he ripped out the trees. Does it literally mean he was going around ripping out trees, or is it a metaphor? It's clearly a metaphor. And then Rabbi Akiva, nichnas b'shalom v'yatzah b'shalom. What I'm saying is that you notice all of the issues over here that are brought up, all of them are metaphoric. Why should we then assume that only the death of Ben Azai is meant to be taken literally? What I'm suggesting then is that if we know that there's a rabbinic understanding that those who don't have children are considered as if they're dead, if Ben Azai's mystical understanding, this source is telling us the danger, that he decides that he must be like Rabbi Akiva, but he's not like Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva already has children. He must be like Rabbi Akiva, he must be like Moshe. Moshe already has children. And now he needs to separate from his wife, which means he's trying to do something which may be a very wonderful thing, but he's just not doing it at the right time. He's not ready to be living in this way, and that's why they attack him. And specifically now you realize the irony of the attack, Yeshna edoresh v'na mekayim, especially when we realize the word dorish at times doesn't mean only to preach. It also has the connotation of meditate. As if then they're saying to him, it's wonderful that you're involved in meditation, but what about keeping the mitzvot? If you're being involved in mysticism is causing you not to lead a normal Jewish life, then there's a very serious problem there. Therefore, I'm willing to suggest the following. Was Ben Azai a rabbi? Was he not a rabbi? Yes, he was a rabbi. Why and when did they stop referring to him as rabbi? When he starts to lead his life in such a way that they don't want to use him as a role model. Was Ben Azai married? Was he not married? He was married, but he separated from his wife, and therefore we have that confusion as well. Was Ben Azai killed in paradise? So is he one of the 10 martyrs? So the answer is, he's listed on all of these lists with the 10 martyrs. Correct. Which means there's an aspect which stops by paradise, but when does he die? So it depends. Do you mean metaphorically, or when does he die literally? He dies with the 10 martyrs, and that's why he deserves to be on the list, but he doesn't physically die by paradise. If that's the case, we've now resolved all of the contradictions. But the one thing which really isn't contradicted is that he really is considered to be a chassid. And even that source that I told you before, it says whoever sins, it says water, water by the sixth gate, is accused of being somebody who kissed the golden calf. It could be that as far as that image is, you have one of two choices by Har Sinai. Either you're like Moshe Rabbeinu, who succeeds in going up into heaven, or you're something other than that. Which means when you try to go up through the Heichalot from level to level in heaven, it's very dangerous. If you make a mistake, you're considered to be theologically the opposite of what Moshe is, succeeds. Rabbi Akiva is like Moshe. Rabbi Akiva succeeds in going up into heaven. But if you fail, then what else? If you had a split screen, what's going on at that time? the Jews down below dancing and kissing the golden calf. Moshe Rabbeinu at the same time up in heaven. Which means if you don't succeed in going up in heaven, then they accuse you of being the other thing. On the other hand, for posterity, then Azai is definitely considered to be one of the Hasidim, one of the Tzadikim. In fact, we'll look at the last source for today. Gemara and Brachot, source 13. It says, Shalosh Chachamim Heim. He was one of the people that were killed with the martyrs. There are three sages. If you see Ben Azai in a dream, which may happen tonight after studying about him today, if you see Ben Azai in a dream, that you can expect a life of chasidut, of being somebody who really is pious. Ben Zoma, if you see Ben Zoma in a dream, Yitzpeh L'Chachma, you can expect a life of wisdom. If you see Acher, Elisha Ben Avuya, Yid'og Min HaParanut, you should be worried for punishment, worried for terrible things that will happen. But to understand that, we need to study about Elisha Ben Avuya, and that will do on Wednesday, right? So we will continue on Wednesday.